Take two. Let's get into Matthew chapter 19 this morning and look at just the first couple of verses. It came about that when Jesus had finished these words, he departed from Galilee and came into the region of Judea beyond the Jordan. And great multitudes followed him, and he healed them there. And so we do not know precisely, of course, where Jesus was, but it would be in a region something like this. We've just been told that he has concluded, it's over, that long ministry, 3 years, up in Galilee. He is now coming south. He's going to be coming through Jericho eventually, and then going back up to Jerusalem, where, of course, he's going to pass away. And so what we're looking at is a kind of a unique moment where after such a long time in Galilee, Jesus knows this is the last journey. And as he's coming south, we're going to find him now probably 2 to 4 weeks before the actual crucifixion, somewhere we think down in this region or probably even on this side, but it could be anywhere between the Sea of Galilee down here, you know, and eventually Jericho that he'll come to in a moment. And so he's in a region just like this where they have to this day dug pits filled with water for baptismal ceremonies. It is a very famous tourist region and all of that. But it's also very easy travel. As you can see, this is the plain of Moab. These are the mountains of Moab. Mount Nebo is going to be up there in that range. And Jesus has been coming down for many miles this river valley that you see just beyond this barren hill right here. Now, I've been saying we're studying Matthew chapter 19, verses 3 through 12, but we also are going to be weaving into it simultaneously Mark chapter 10 in verses 2 through 12. So I've handed out some material here. We'll talk about it in just a second, but again, some people have been filtering in. Make sure you have a copy of the single sheet. It has two columns on one side and some shaded words on the other. If you don't, there'll be some back on the table there in the foyer. Matthew 19, chapter 19, verses 3 through 12, brethren, has, as I mentioned in our very first class with this slide, has proven to be the most awful battlefield throughout all of history. Before Moses, during Moses' law, during the time of Christ, and down to this day, this discussion of marriage and divorce and remarriage has troubled absolutely every religious group that's ever been interested in the Bible in any way, shape, or form. There's something about this material that I suspect, because of the way Jesus described why he preached in parables, why he said, Paul said in the Thessalonian letter that God can send a strong delusion, God does not always make it easy. And on this particular passage, at least, it takes a little more effort. I can see why. I think we all can see why. That there's a number of these different phrases. There's this information from Deuteronomy 24. If you're not well familiar with the Old Testament, particularly Deuteronomy 24, then you're not holding that data in your head while you're studying Matthew 19. And there'll be several forks in the road where, based on the decision you make at that fork, your entire paradigm of marriage and divorce through the ages, going back to the garden, becomes altered, and there's really nothing you can do about it save march back, as I've been forced to do, told you so many times, to look at each one of these forks again, year after year after year, and say, well, okay, you know, maybe I see now how this other choice would be a better one. Let's see what all the dominoes do after that. So here's been our problem, Matthew 19, 3 through 12. And brethren, there's been an enormous number of churches divided, families destroyed, children traumatized because of this passage. I believed, I taught, I counseled people not only publicly but privately that their circumstances required them to undo an existing marriage, children or not, happy or not, both Christians or not, and try to go back to an earlier mate, impossible 99.9% of the time, or be celibate the rest of their lives if they wanted to go to heaven. These are profoundly life-changing decisions. And so when I was counseling those kinds of things, I was surely expecting people to tear their lives completely apart. I've come to think that in the early years of my preaching, at least, and for a couple of decades, I'd made some mistakes, and I wish I could have those exchanges back. But here it is. This is what we've been building to for all these previous 9 classes, hoping that you've been able to stay with me, hoping that you've been able to remember some of this material, hoping that, you know, as we're rolling this big snowball forward, then this morning, finally, this will start to bear some fruit. So I appreciate you've been enormously patient. I realize that I haven't answered a lot of the questions you might have liked to have seen sooner, but I'm truly hoping that with this class, at least, we can come into the most controversial passages, and this is chief among them. 1 Corinthians 7's got some. With a much more solid foundation, much broader, understanding of the Mosaic Law, particularly before we start making these dramatic decisions. Now, for the first time in my preaching career, at least, I've made an extra effort to do this very differently than my previous two recorded times. I spent quite a bit of time creating this document that I've handed out for you this morning. Now, on the front, it says Matthew 19, 3 through 12, and Mark 10, 2 through 12, combined, and it has this explanatory paragraph at the top. On the back side, there are two columns. One side has Matthew 19, 1 through 12, in the New American Standard Version, in its entirety, and then the right-hand column has Mark 10, verses 1 through 12, in its entirety. So, you can look at this side first. This is where we'll be spending most of our time, the side that has only one column and has some shaded areas, where I've taken those two passages, which are parallel passages, 2 to 4 weeks before Jesus is crucified. There along the banks of the Jordan River, probably somewhere between the Sea of Galilee and Jericho, Jesus is going to utter these words and have this great battle with the Pharisees. Matthew records it. Mark records it. The other two gospel writers do not. So in the double column, you can see how both stated it. In this column, I have, as I'll now read from the notes, combined the two in this manner. The main text and the verse numbers you see in bold and parenthesis on the left-hand side are all from Matthew 19, verses 3 through 12. Mark's unique material, only the stuff from Mark that is only in Mark, is inserted into Matthew's account and shaded so that it can be readily identified. For instance, you'll notice between verses 3 and 4 of Matthew 19, there's an entire event that Mark records that Matthew does not. So I don't have a verse number in that second paragraph there. It's just all shaded. That tells you it came from Mark 10. Then it says Old Testament quotations, where you've got a verbatim, word-for-word, recitation of an Old Testament passage. Old Testament quotations are printed in all capital letters. And that was done, as a matter of fact, by the New American Standard translators. And I love that feature in all their translations. You can immediately see a direct quotation. So that's just been carried over onto the combined page. Okay? And then it'll be followed by a parenthesis that has the verse reference. So you'll see where that quotation comes from too. Now, this is critically important and will color or shade everything we do this morning. Old Testament paraphrases, something that's frequently done by Jesus and the apostles, Old Testament paraphrases, where clearly the inspired teacher is referencing an Old Testament passage. But he's not quoting it directly. He's giving you an inspired paraphrase. Wherever that occurs in Matthew 19, Old Testament paraphrases by Jesus are likewise printed in all capitals. That's my work. That's not the New American Standard's work. I wanted to help us see the places where Jesus cannot possibly be talking about any other passage in the Old Testament. And every commentator who's ever lived agrees that's the case. I just thought it'd be helpful then that while it's not a direct quote, but it is a direct reference, that I'll put those in capitals as well, and they'll be followed by the parenthesis with the Old Testament's actual wording in all capitals. I'll point these out to you, but where Jesus paraphrases, I'll show you what he said, then I'll show you what he's quoting from, what he's paraphrasing in all caps, and we'll have the reference there included. So, here's what I want to do first this morning. And again, this is a lot of years, brethren, a lot of experience, an awful lot of hours and people, and you know, it's just a culmination of an awful lot of agony, as a matter of fact, on this topic. I'll say to you, I think the one single biggest problem that we have above everything in Matthew 19 is how easy it is to just forget what went before. And we get all locked up and mired in some phrase that we're just analyzing the pieces and we lose all knowledge of the forest. And so as I worked with people for decades, I found that to be my single biggest problem, is helping them to remain aware of what the rest of the passage says, what the context holds, why it is that when we come to each of these forks in the road, we can only rightly take one of them and everything changes whichever we pick, that the context will tell us which one we should have taken. Often enough, it wasn't the one I took, but the one we should be taking will indicate itself if we can just keep all the data in our heads. So I'm going to start this morning by just simply reading through this combined statement and this merged data so we have the totality, the sum of God's worth in this one moment there, likely by the banks of the Jordan River, somewhere between Jericho and Galilee. So just read with me from the sheet that has the shading. Let's just try to get this under our belts and get it deeply in our minds and try to remember it all before we go tearing up people's lives in a misunderstood interpretation of any part of it. So here we go. Verse 3. Some Pharisees came up to Jesus, testing him, and began to question him whether it was lawful for a man to divorce a wife, asking, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason at all?" And he answered and said to them, from Mark, not recorded in Matthew, he answered and said to them, "What did Moses command you?" They said, "Moses permitted a man to write a certificate of divorce and send her away." Genesis 24:1 is being quoted. Verse 4 of Matthew 19. He answered and said, "Have you not read that God, he who created them from the beginning of creation, made them male and female, and said, 'For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh.' So, they're no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate." Verse 7. They said to him, "Why then did Moses command to give her a certificate of divorce and send her away?" Verse 8. He, Jesus, said to them, "Because of your hardness of heart, Moses wrote you this commandment and permitted you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning, it has not been this way." Verse 9. "And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife, except for fornication, and marries another woman, commits adultery." In the house, the disciples began questioning him about this again. So the Pharisees now, they've left. Jesus takes his disciples into a house, and this comes up again. In the house, the disciples began questioning him about this again. And he said to them, "Whoever divorces his wife and marries another woman commits adultery against her. And if she herself divorces her husband and marries another man, she is committing adultery." Verse 10. The disciples said to him, "If the relationship of the man with his wife is like this, it is better not to marry." But he said to them, "Not all men can accept this statement, but only those to whom it has been given." Verse 12, "For there are eunuchs who were born that way from their mother's womb. And there are eunuchs who were made eunuchs by men. And there are also eunuchs who made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. He who is able to accept this, let him accept it." And the passage ends. We have totally different subject matter when you open up to verse 13. That's the whole thing. Now, let me give you a list of just some, and by no means all, of these forks in the road that I'm talking about. So the points of divergence, the points of contention, the reason there's been a civil war going on over marriage, divorce, and remarriage, who can divorce and who can't, under what circumstances you may or may not, who can get married after one, all those questions arise because of Matthew 19. So here are just big points of contention that resulted in this war from the garden to today. Number one, in Matthew 19:6. Now you can go back and find it on the single page, or you can get it out the double page, double column, you know, if you like. Take your pick there. But look at Matthew 19:6. In 19:6, does that phrase, "let no man separate," does that mean it's impossible to separate, or does it mean stop separating? I've studied with Greek scholars. I've talked to the head of a Greek department in one of our colleges. I have, you know, researched this thing. And so, brethren, I found out that there's one way to understand that. I understand that in English and in Greek, you could get an idea out of there, but only one of those is right, and they're radically different. Does the phrase mean, let no man separate mean you can't separate? It's impossible to separate. No separation ever takes place. Divorce can't happen. God thinks you're still married. You just suppose that you've been divorced, but you really haven't. There's handcuff charts and all that stuff, you know, been through all that for hours. Is, you know, all these ideas about, no, you cannot separate because God joined it together. So no divorce took place. You just think it did. It's just civil, and that doesn't matter. That's one way you can go, and everything changes if you go that way. The other way says, well, sure, you can divorce, and you guys are doing much too much of it, so cut it out. Now, which one does the phrase actually mean? Is it, you can't separate, you just think you have, or don't do that anymore? I'm not going to answer it here. Number two, in 19:8, hardness of heart is really a big problem. In 19:8, because of your hardness of heart, Moses wrote you this commandment. Is the hardness of heart directed toward God? My old view, a popular view, a view that's declining in favor now, and I'm really glad to find that out. Was it directed toward God, or was it directed toward the adulterous wife? Is the man in Deuteronomy 24 with the hard heart Is he rebellious against God, and the wife isn't even being discussed in Deuteronomy 24? Or has she done something that has hardened his heart toward her? Whatever decision you make there absolutely changes everything for the rest of your understanding of marriage and divorce and remarriage. Only one of those can be right. Number three, again in 19:8, and again with the hardness of heart. Is there hardness of heart in Deuteronomy 24 anywhere? Now, most people act as if it's not. I'm suggesting that it is. That most people seem to think that it's not. They read into Deuteronomy 24 what they have erroneously concluded from Matthew 19. They've taken the hardness of heart in Matthew 19, assumed it's toward God, and then admit or think that it doesn't appear anywhere in Deuteronomy 24. It's just that at long last, Jesus tells us why we got Deuteronomy 24. Well, whatever you choose changes everything. Again in verse 8, but this time in 19:8, is the phrase permitted you to divorce your wives? Moses permitted you to divorce your wives. Is that an unencumbered authorization that's perfectly fine and acceptable to God and man? There is no strings attached. There's nothing unhappy about it, save the fact that we got this problem going on. But you're permitted. You're allowed. You have a license. It's perfectly correct legally to do this thing. Or is this an unwilling concession where either God or Moses or both didn't like this idea, didn't want this idea, wouldn't permit this idea until Deuteronomy, but now, very grudgingly, they're going to say, well, okay, if you're rebellious and hardened your heart against me, God, then I'll let you have your way. Now, I really don't want you to go off and divorce all these wives. I don't want you tearing up those families, traumatizing those kids. I don't want any of that, but I'm going to let you do it for 1,500 years because, after all, your heart's hard toward me. You don't want to serve me, so okay, have it your way. Those are radically different ideas. One of them originates in a terrible King James Version translation and has been passionately embraced by enormous numbers of people. And it's just a bad translation, pure and simple. That's why other translations after that don't use a particular word we'll be talking about. Now, that's the origination of this idea. Or this unwilling, I say that backwards, permitted you to divorce your wives, I'm trying to say. In one case, it's permitted by God, fine. In the other case, it's not. I lost my own train of thought there. I'm sure one of those I was working with, so I'm in a hurry, but let it go. Now, five. In 19:8, is from the beginning it has not been this way. Now, before we go any farther, brethren, this one is just gargantuan. It is so colossal. The decision you make here is just a toweringly important decision. So, from the beginning, it has not been this way. There is some way that has never been allowed from the beginning. It's never been this way. Now, what way is it that at no point in time did God ever allow? Which one is it? You got two choices. Is it Moses' way? Moses' law? The Ten Commandments going forward for the Jews only, and forget the Gentiles, you know, they're not involved in this, is the way the theory goes, but is from the beginning it has not been this way, saying Moses' law did not exist in the Garden of Eden? Or is there some other way that has never existed since the Garden of Eden? Now, my old view, I was completely blind and unable to even consider or conceive, and I've checked with Greek scholars, that certainly there's another way that contextually, I believe, is demanded. I didn't even know it existed. I didn't even know it was a possibility. I didn't even know it was an option. I thought, surely, this has to refer back to Moses' law. Moses' law was not in the Garden of Eden, was it? Well, no. What I think I was missing, though, is that whatever this way is, from the time Jesus is talking through the preceding 1500 years and all the way back to Genesis, the way Jesus is talking about was never allowed. Ever. That's one other way to understand this verse. And in 19:9, is there fornication in Deuteronomy 24:1? I used to think not. Deuteronomy 24:1, which is cited twice or three times in this passage between Matthew and Mark, that passage is being quoted, that passage is being paraphrased. And I used to think that it was talking about divorce for anything other than fornication. One of the foremost debaters, a man whose name I won't utter, but who, you know, made quite a reputation and career out of it for decades, you know, as a quote in which he says, Deuteronomy 24 is talking about things less than fornication. In his view, widely disseminated through the debates, there's no fornication in Deuteronomy 24 at all. It isn't even being discussed. It's being left off the table so God can lower the standard, let Jews who don't want to serve God make their wives pay for it, because now for 1,500 years they can divorce them for whatever reason they like, for any reason at all. Those, you know, are the big ones, and there's a bunch of others. So, what I'd like to do next is to help us to appreciate, brethren, that we've got in our minds, I think I know in mine at least, we've got a really negative feeling. We just cramp up whenever we hear the word paraphrase. The paraphrases got really popular back in the 60s and 70s. They brutalized God's word. They put pure Baptist doctrine where the scripture says nothing. They put all kinds of stuff into the Bible that weren't there because they weren't translating at all. They were just telling you what they thought the scriptures meant. So the various translators were putting their own doctrinal ideas in there. And so we fought that war, fought it well, fought it hard, fought it for good reason. A paraphrased Bible that is reflecting a particular doctrinal opinion and not what the words say in the original language is a real bad thing. So, you know, we hate it. We just get all upset. But brethren, paraphrasing is done by Jesus, the apostles, the other prophets constantly. It's all over. What is paraphrasing? And let's make sure we understand the grand difference, you know, between the living Bible and, you know, what paraphrasing can be very appropriate. Here's Merriam-Webster. A paraphrase is a restatement of a text, passage, or work giving the meaning in another form. When you get a paraphrase from Jesus, now you've got two different ways of getting to the same truth. It's only one truth, but he said it with these words, and he said it with those words. I could quote and read the words in the Old Testament, or I could read Jesus' paraphrase over here in the New, where he is a Jew teaching Jews how to understand Moses' law. Merriam-Webster tells us, well, Jesus, it was okay for you to do that. Cambridge Dictionary says, to state something in different words, especially in a shorter and simpler form, to make the meaning clearer. Well, that's what they were doing in the Living Bible, but they were making their meaning, their doctrine, not God's, clearer. We're looking for inspired paraphrases. And lastly, we've got online, and it didn't identify a particular dictionary, so I don't know what it was, but it says, to express the meaning of the writer using different words, especially to achieve greater clarity. Paraphrasing is about, well, here's what the text says, but you're not sure what it means. Okay, let me paraphrase it so that I can give you clearer meaning. Now you know what that passage says. Okay, now, in the use of paraphrasing, Jesus does it, the apostles do it, the prophets often did it. You know, it's everywhere. So, and the word for this, by the way, is allusion. Not illusion, but allusion. A-L-L-U-S-I-O-N. When you allude to a passage, you are intending to have people get the same idea out of that passage without using the passage's actual words. You're paraphrasing is what an allusion is. Now, I'm going to do some of that this morning. Now, I may be totally wrong, but what I'm going to now do is take the single column page that I produced for you, the synthesis or the combining of Matthew and Mark, and I'm going to ask you to watch that. Look at that. Those are the actual biblical words, that alteration. Okay? But I'm going to now paraphrase it so that I will give you how I understand the passage. Now, I may be wrong. It's an uninspired paraphrase. But there's no problem with paraphrasing in itself. It's perfectly legal. I hope it'll help you to get at least an understanding of where I am and maybe save us some time in the process. Now, I'll put these all up, but you know, I recognize it may be hard for you to read it on the screen right there. But all these green-backed slides, those backgrounds, are designed for you to know these are now my words, so I'm paraphrasing. But if you'll look closely at the combined sheet, this is how I would understand verse 3. So, some Pharisees tried to trap Jesus by asking, "Are you with us Pharisees who follow Hillel and therefore divorce our wives for any reason at all? Or are you with Shammai who believes divorce is only for fornication? Does the law teach fornication only, divorce for fornication only, or for any reason at all?" Now, you all know that background. Every preacher you've ever listened to on this topic has told you about that. Hillel and Shammai, first century guys, two big groups. The Pharisees were Hillelites. You can divorce for any reason at all. Shammai had a less popular view. Shammai was the conservative. Shammai said no. Deuteronomy's talking about fornication. Shammai's view, therefore, wasn't nearly so popular as the Pharisees' view. Under Shammai's view of Deuteronomy, you can't divorce your wife for any reason at all. So that's what I get out of verse 3. They were trying to trap him because the Pharisees were on Hillel's side and they wanted to get Jesus on Shammai's side, thinking if they could, they got him. And they could claim that he was violating Moses' law. And he answered and said to them, "What did Moses command you?" And they said, "Moses agrees with Hillel and us in Deuteronomy 24:1. The certificate of divorce is for any reason at all, not just sexual sin." Verses 4 and 5, he answered and said, "Haven't you ever even read Genesis 1:27 or 2:24? No! You're absolutely wrong. Deuteronomy 24:1 does not teach that divorce can be for any reason at all." Verse 6. Genesis says that married people are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together in marriage, you Pharisees need to stop separating through divorce. Verse 7. They said to him, "Why then did Moses command to give her a certificate of divorce? Deuteronomy 24:1 says we can divorce for any reason at all. But you're contradicting Moses. You fell right into our trap, Jesus. We got you now." It's what they are stated to be aiming for in the first verse. Verse 8. Nobody catches Jesus in a trap. Jesus said, "Because men's hearts are hardened against their adulterous wives, Moses wrote Deuteronomy 24:1 and permitted you to divorce adulteresses. But from the beginning, it has never been this way of divorcing wives for any reason at all that you are defending." Verse 9. "I say to you, Moses taught, whoever divorces his wife except for the matters of nakedness, stipulated in Deuteronomy 24:1, and marries another woman, commits adultery. Shammai is right. Hillel and you Pharisees are dead wrong. From Mark's gospel, in the house, the disciples began questioning him about this again. He said to them, whoever divorces his wife, in this case I've inserted what we had before, except for fornication, whoever divorces his wife, except in that case, and marries another woman, commits adultery against her. And if she herself divorces her husband, except for fornication, and marries another man, she's committing adultery. The disciple said to him, if the relationship of the man with his wife is like this, it is better not to marry. You 1 Corinthians 7 students, I hope, will remember, we had a big discussion about that in 1 Corinthians 7, didn't we? It's better not to marry. The disciple said, if the relationship of the man with his wife's like this, it's better not to marry. But he said to them, not all men can simply accept your statement and therefore choose to live without marital sex. Only certain men have the ability to remain celibate. Now, I want to be very careful here. Most people do not understand this word celibate. Celibate does not mean go without sex. It means not be married. Marriages exist whether you have sex or not. Loads of people are married, joined together by God, who never engage in sexual intercourse. That's not what celibate means. Celibate means not married. So again, he said, not all men can simply accept your statement and therefore choose to live without marital sex. That is to be, unmarried, but only certain men have the ability to remain celibate, to remain unmarried. Now he's going to tell you what those three kinds of guys are. There are celibate men, they're unmarried men, who are born without the desire or ability to have sex. So obviously they're not seeking out a mate. They don't see the need, don't feel the urgency. And there are celibate men who were made that way because someone castrated them. And there are also celibate men who are able to make themselves celibate for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. Only the men in these three conditions are able to remain unmarried. Let them accept your astute conclusion that it is better not to marry. It is better not to marry for three kinds of people. But not for everybody else, only for those three. Now, that's where I'm at. So here's where I, made all those decisions. Jesus is a Jew teaching Jews how to be Jews under their law, which is Moses' law, because that's the question that was asked. He didn't dodge the Pharisees' question. He didn't ignore it. He didn't go teach something totally unrelated so they couldn't possibly understand what he was doing. He answered the question they asked. What does Deuteronomy 24 teach? So Jesus taught them what it teaches. Do not think I came to abolish the law or the prophets. For a lot of years, I really acted as if that's exactly what Jesus did. My view accepts that he wasn't doing that under the law before he died. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill. Whoever annuls one of the least of these commandments, including Deuteronomy 24:1, and teaches others to do the same. Now, I've been teaching on that passage, Jesus says, since the Sermon on the Mount, and I'm teaching on it here in Perea with you guys. Whoever annuls one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same shall be called least in the kingdom. Verse 2 later says you can't even enter it. Jesus, before the cross, is an inspired teacher of Moses' law. That's what he's doing. So, green background, here's my personal understanding of Matthew 19, 3 through 12. Number one, Moses did not give the Jews any new or different marital law that had been unknown to Adam or Abraham or anybody else prior to Deuteronomy 24. Jesus did not do that. Number two, Number two, Moses did not permit rebellious men to disobey or change God's marital law. Number three, Moses did not permit rebellious men to violate marital vows or abandon their wives and children. Moses never did any such thing. Number four, Moses did not permit Jews to have a lower standard of marital law than the Gentiles had. The Gentiles don't have any law at all that's written, and you think they're being held to the higher standard back in Genesis, and now not the Jews for 1,500 years? Well, I thought that, and I don't anymore. Moses didn't permit Jews to have a lower standard of marital law than the Gentiles. Number five, Jesus taught exactly what Moses taught. Number six, Jesus did not abolish, annul, set aside, supersede, improve, or rise above Moses' law. He wasn't teaching Christian doctrine. He was talking to Pharisees, and he hadn't died yet. He was telling them what the law said. Seven, Jesus did not give Jews new or different marital law that was unknown to Adam, Abraham, or Moses. Jesus did not do that. If so, he'd be annulling Moses, disqualifying himself as our sacrifice for sin, and breaking his own promise that he didn't come to do that. Eight, Jesus ordered the Pharisees to stop divorcing their wives for things less than adultery. That's what he was doing. Stop your sin. Stop your violation of Deuteronomy 24. Number nine, Jesus left God's marital law exactly the same way it had been from the Garden of Eden. Didn't change a thing. Number 10, Jesus agreed with God. He agreed with Adam. He agreed with Abraham. He agreed with Moses. He agreed with Shammai and not Hillel. And he agrees with Paul in the three classes we'll have on 1 Corinthians 7. And Paul's going to elaborate on this. Paul's going to tell us, here are the things that Jesus didn't talk about because he was never a Christian. Here are the things we have to deal with now that he's risen from the dead. Jesus, before he dies, he agreed with God, Abraham, God, Adam, Abraham, Moses, Shammai, and Paul, eventually, on marital law. So, what Jesus disagreed with in the Sermon on the Mount and in Matthew 19, Mark 10, he disagreed with Hillel, that libertine, violating marriage law, divorcing for any reason at all, and trying to blame Moses for it. He disagreed with Hillel and those Pharisees on marital law. The only marital law that there's always been going back to the garden, because it never changed ever in the history of humankind from the garden to now. Nobody was ever allowed to monkey with marital law because they had hard hearts toward God. I used to think so, but I sure don't anymore. Okay?